And, you know, today I get to talk to two sets of guests about the subjects I feel most passionate about, and they are health security and access to health care, as well as food security issues. On the last program I hosted in January, I introduced a new feature, a series I'm calling Revolutionary Soup. What I basically said then, and I'm going to paraphrase myself, is I've been thinking how we can spark our imaginative thinking about relationships of all kinds and also about the many challenges that face us now and ways we choose or don't choose to engage. Revolutionary Soup is and will be a series of wide-ranging conversations about food and our relationship with it, as well as the relationship of food to tradition, community, health, the environment, and other local and global issues. Last month, my first guest in the series was Deborah Madison, chef, award-winning cookbook author, and food activist. And today, I welcome a guest who is the rarest of beings on Women's Focus, and that is a person of the other gender. As soon as I, and he's chuckling at that. As soon as I heard the title of Mark Winnie's new book and read about it, I shot an email to his publicist because I wanted him to be on the program. Mark has a newly published book, Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cooking Mamas, Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture, and that's published by Beacon Press. It's an exceptional book and an important one, and it's certainly is so perfect for what I wanted to see discussed in this series, Revolutionary Soup. So let me tell you a little something about Mark. For almost 25 years, he was the executive director of the Hartford Food Systems, a nonprofit that works on food and hunger issues in the Hartford, Connecticut area. He organized community self-help projects that assisted the city's lower-income and elderly residents. He developed Connecticut's Farmers Market Nutrition Program, also a 25-acre community-supported agricultural farms, a food bank, food and nutrition educational programs, and more. Mark Winnie is a co-founder of a number of food and agricultural policy groups. He currently writes, speaks, and consults on community food system topics, including hunger and food insecurity and food policy. His essays and opinion pieces have appeared in the Boston Globe, The Nation, In These Times, Yes Magazine, just to name a few. He's also the author of the very well-received 2008 book, Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. Mark lives in Santa Fe, where he serves on the Santa Fe Food Policy Council, and I believe the Southwest Grass-Fed Livestock Alliance. So welcome, Mark. I'm really excited about the concept of Revolutionary Soup, and I'm really very, very excited to have you on the program. You are the perfect second guest for this.
Well, thank you, Carol. And I guess it's an honor to be here.
Yeah, it is an honor, and it's an honor to have you here. To begin with, I just want to read a short piece from one of your blogs, and we'll let people know later on where they could where your website is and about your blog. So Mark writes on one of these blogs, as everyone knows by now, the industrial food system has taken its toll on our bodies, communities, and environment. While many of us struggle to find a sound alternative, food that is fair, affordable, green, and healthy, the facts don't point to enormous progress. If we're to triumph, ultimately triumph, over a food system that puts profits before people, in other words, if we are to make the millions of consumers and citizens who now subscribe to a food system based on justice and sustainability into billions of people, we're going to have to make food democracy a reality, not just a slogan. And we are going to have to invest in individuals both as leaders and as empowered eaters. So I think that blog piece sort of says a whole lot of what your concerns are and really what your book is about. And Mark just had a laugh because I showed him all these little, what do you call these things?
That's a rainbow of little noogie things that you...
Noogie things that you stick on pages.
I used to use them in college, too, so I could
but
find
much
all the
much
things that I needed
now
for my tests.
Right, yeah. So instead of underlining, you can mark a page and it sticks out of the book. Well, I must have 50,000 of them in this book.
Yeah, it's quite the rainbow.
Yeah, it's quite the rainbow. Your first chapter in the book is called A Food Story for Our Time, and it's way too long for you to read. And I was telling you, it blew me away. It's Kirkus Reviews said it was an apocalyptic opening sequence, and I know I was immediately pulled in. It's really, really gripping, and some of it's a little scary. And it really sets the stage for what's to follow in your book. And I was wondering if you could just, you know, without reading that chapter, mm-hmm. and I know you were thinking about reading a quote that that was at the very beginning of your book from Dostoevsky, I think.
Yeah. Well, I was the beginning of the book is hopefully people will figure out pretty quickly that it's fiction. But it's not too far off from the truth, which I think is what makes it hopefully powerful and engaging. And I'd also say, to some degree, it's autobiographical. I mean, it's a bit about the way I feel about our food. And I think that many of us keep trying to find an alternative to food that's produced in factory farms that creates a variety of water and air pollution that produces food that is largely not good for our bodies. You know, many of us have kind of tried to escape that system and find something else. But at the same time, we realize in our perhaps bluer moments and our darker moments that it's not that easy. And we have a long way, a very long way to go. And we sometimes get frustrated when we realize that we are in the minority. Really, the people who are looking for good food and who are starting to actually find it are the smaller number of us. And so the description in the book, in the beginning of the book, tells a story about a guy who is pretty close to me and finds out that you know, he's kind of caved in, that he's thought that he was getting like really good food from different sources, but then he realized he could get it maybe even cheaper at a place that bears a resemblance to a very large retail chain in the United States. He found that that the number of farmers at his favorite farmer's market were dwindling because they just couldn't make a living anymore. They were going out of business. He was finding out that even the great honey that's produced throughout northern New Mexico had begun to dry up for a variety of reasons, including changes in the environment, perhaps chemicals, and even maybe more disheartening, the fact that many farmers were just giving up, and young people weren't interested in going into farming anymore. So he reaches this sort of bottom, this kind of point where it's just, even though he's trying to find some relief in his own garden, he just realizes that it's kind of like he feels like it's hopeless. So there's a sort of sense of despair. But events change, and he finds hope, and there are good reasons for that. And then the story begins to shift, I think, overall back into nonfiction and descriptions of what is going on in our food system. And then a lot of very, I think, important stories,
yes.
Important because they really tell us that there is a future for a good, fair, just food system.
Yeah, and we're going to definitely get into that. And what Mark was beginning to talk about again is that first chapter. And what's really interesting in your book, I find moment you do relay some statistics and some realities in our society in regards to our food system. And sometimes, you know, I can sink when I read that and I think, oh, it's really hopeless. But one thing you do in this book is plug in there with the hope and the possibilities, and it's really a marvelous story of that you tell us all. In fact, it's not a story; it's what's happening and what can happen. So, maybe you could talk a little bit about what ultimately is at stake. In other words, in terms of the struggle for the control of our food system, which is very, very real. And in fact, I think it's your second chapter that's called "The Fight for the Soul of the American Food System."
Right. One thing that I actually have realized lately, and anybody who's just pays attention to what's going on with food, and anybody who reads a newspaper, who checks in online, will know that there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on all the time, and a lot of it isn't always good news. And I was sort of it occurred to me the other day when I was thinking about the beginning of my book that I said, well, why is it that so many things I'm reading in the newspaper today, which are what is actually going on, the things that I was writing about in my book early, in the early chapter that I was kind of making up, but now they're true. And this is only, you know, it's only been about, you know, less than 2 years since I was, you know, putting, you know, ink to paper to create the book. And so, you know, right now we just had a ruling by the U.S. Department of Agriculture to allow for the genetically modified alfalfa to be planted. Just also had another ruling that allows for the genetically modified sugar beet production that had been kind of held off by the courts for a long time, but finally the USDA has pushed that through. We see Walmart pushing into areas of our lives where many of us aren't very comfortable at all, that they're beginning to kind of take over even more and more our food supply. So these are things that I talked about in the early part of my book, and I described them in various ways. And now they're coming true. Not that I'm necessarily that prescient in any sense, but it's also, but it just does seem to be discouraging. And you know, when we talk about, I think we have to realize that, you know, the amount of food that is produced in accordance with some of our values, that where we respect fairness and we respect food that's produced without chemicals and produced sustainably and takes responsibility for how it's produced, in other words, and to say nothing of just local food, that's a pretty small percentage of our total food supply. On a good day, going downhill with the wind to our back, it's about 10% of all our food. I was at a conference just the other day where there was some discussion about just how much food that is being purchased now is organic, and the number is about 3%. So you can be discouraged by these numbers because they are so small relative to the larger industrial food system. But I think on the other hand, you can begin to kind of take hope that change is underway.
Right. So talk about the differentiation that you made between the industrial food system and the alternative food system. That concept weaves through your book.
Well, the industrial food system is our dominant form of food production and distribution that has been evolving since World War II. And it's one that relies on more farms, larger farms, using industrial type production techniques in the same way that you can imagine, you know, a car being made on an assembly line, you know, a method that was perfected by someone like Henry Ford back in like the 1920s. You know, we have adopted those kinds of procedures for producing food in this country. Mm-hmm. So we want really large facilities because we feel that those are economically more efficient. They produce more food. They produce it cheaply. And in fact, you know, we of course have become more dependent on agrochemicals from fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, and so forth. Genetically modified food is becoming more prevalent. And things like the use of antibiotics on livestock, non-therapeutic use of antibiotics. In other words, the animal is not sick. It's simply being given injections of antibiotics to prevent it from getting sick. And the reason they need to do that is because the animals are confined. There's too many of them in one place. So the possibility that they will get sick is much higher. However, 70% of all the antibiotics in this country are now being used on livestock. And as a result of that overuse, humans are now becoming antibiotic resistant. So, we keep relying on these kinds of methods, which really act in defiance of nature. They act in defiance, really, of good science. The more you pay attention to it. On the other hand, we have this I refer to it loosely as the alternative food system. It's this place where we feel like we have some relationship to our food. We hope that sometimes we know the farmers personally. Sometimes we want to know where the food is coming from. We want to certainly make sure that it's not being produced with chemicals, or at least too many chemicals. We believe in this idea of sustainability, so that the natural resources themselves that the food depends on for its production are not being used up, and that people will be able to farm hopefully forever. So we have a whole number of values, you might say, that go into our decisions about what we buy and what we eat. And we see this daily at, say, a farmer's market. We see it at a co-op. We see it in our own backyard or in a community garden setting where we actually have our hands in the dirt and we're trying to produce some of our own food. We see it now more in our schools, which are actually buying food from farmers. I think it's close to 2/3 of the school children in New Mexico are at least getting some locally produced food on a fairly regular basis now. These are many examples of what we would consider to be the alternative food system, and it's one that is growing, but yet it is still small in relation to that dominant industrial food system.
A little bit later on, I want to talk about children in New Mexico and how it's come to be that almost 2/3 are getting at least some local food. You know, in your chapter, which is called The Fight for the Soul of the American Food System, and by the way, this is Women's Focus that you're in tune to. My name is Carol Boss, and my guest this afternoon, this first part of the program, is Mark Winnie. He is the author of Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cooking Mamas, Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture. You're talking a little bit about local, buying local food, and you say that has sort of attained near legendary status. That's that word local, and you write that I want to suggest a significant feature of local that doesn't always find its way into the critique, and that is the notion of intimacy. If true intimacy between two or more people, whether in a family, between lovers and among friends, or with a higher being, is one of the most rewarding of all human experiences, then the intimacy that might exist between a person and non-human things, animals, plants, landscapes, may offer similar rewards. Knowing where your food comes has become an unfortunate cliche in the local food movement, but if one is able to use food as a bridge to a richer world of possibilities, nature in the land, gardening, a heritage of farming and ranching, family meals, spiritual and religious practices, then a variety of doors are flung open that can lead to new pathways. And this notion does weave its way through your book. And
did I write that?
You did, and it's lovely. Yes, it is. You also mentioned that Charles Kuralt on the road, mm-hmm. on his On the Road program years ago, wrote, "Thanks to the internet highway system, it is now possible to travel from coast to coast without seeing anything." And thanks to the industrial, this is you now, thanks to the industrial food system, it is now possible to eat whatever we want, whenever we want, without having a clue about who produced it or where. Anonymity, that sad beast of modernism, is just one of many Achilles' heels of our industrial food model.
Yeah, I mean, it is. This idea of intimacy is one that I've been playing with, in many ways in my life, of course, over the years. But certainly I realize how important it is with food. I mean, you can have arguments with people, good friends, colleagues, and they can be, friendly arguments about, say, the economics of food. I've had many people criticize me, and I've heard these discussions in different forms. Someone who's highly rational and a good person says, well, you can buy this food cheaper at Walmart, or you can buy it cheaper at Albertsons, and it's perfectly good, and it's probably safe, and it's not going to kill you. And you can do it a lot cheaper than you can grow it yourself, or even maybe buy it from a farmer's market. Mm-hmm. And so those arguments are fairly common. I think we've all heard them. But there's this one piece of it that keeps nagging at me, which is experiencing food this way, whether I'm growing it or buying it in a more personal setting, does create intimacy. It's about a connection, and it does touch you, you know, in your heart and in your head and in your soul, and just in the same way that the food eventually touches you in the stomach. And it is very rich and powerful. And I think back on where I got started in this 40 or even 50 years ago, trying to grow a few watermelons in the backyard of my much too shady suburban New Jersey home and wondering why they didn't grow. It was because I wanted to have some kind of, you know, I wanted to touch something. I wanted it to be very close to me. I wanted it to be personal. I wanted to be moved by the experience. And as my life has moved on, I have found that this experience just won't go away. This feeling won't go away, and I don't want it to. And you know, and I use a comparison to romantic relationships, of course, and in the sense how important those are and what is important about them. Well, that's that rare intimate relationship that you have with somebody that you don't have with anyone else. You know, that is indeed the most powerful thing that you'll probably ever experience. Mm-hmm. In the same way that it might be if it was a religious experience. And I think that can be transferred to food. And it is. And it's not just food, because it takes us also to the environment. It takes us to our communities. It takes us, you know, right down into those precious 6 inches of soil that is all that stands between us and extinction.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. On a few weeks ago, when I had Deborah Madison on, and I introduced my concept as best as I could, because it's still growing in my head, of revolutionary soup. For me, as I said just a little bit ago on this show, it's about relationships, and it's a relationship we have to each other, and in this case to food, which is also about relationships to people and community. And for me, it started sharing soup. Mm-hmm. With some friends earlier this year or this last year, and out of it grew some really strong friendships and wonderful conversation, and it's been a really important part of my life.
Yeah.
And in some ways, you know, you think about what revolutionary means. What's happening in Egypt is revolutionary, right. But it's also down to the bare bones level of sharing food with another person, which mm-hmm. a lot of us have lost that kind of connection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And I, you know, it's like you can think this, to some people, this might sound, you know, like, well, it's nice and warm and fuzzy. But, you know, consider the opposite of that, of intimacy. You know, it's that running around, that, you know, hurry scurry kind of life that we, too many of us, unfortunately, live. I refer to that, you know, that sad beast of modernity, which is anonymity, you know, not knowing people, not even being known ourselves, kind of moving about in a, like we're ghosts almost, in a place where we live, but we have no physical connection to, and certainly no spiritual connection to. And, you know, it's like our food system wants to feed that. It needs that kind of disconnect, because if we stopped and looked carefully at what we're doing, if we realized that, I mean, many of us are actually eating 20-30% of our food in our cars as we're driving around, stopping at you know, drive-in takeout places, on the road. People, they actually did one piece of research of to find out what did people care most about when they made a decision to buy a car. Well, they actually cared more about the cup holders than they did the gas mileage in the car. And this is what's going on.
That's interesting.
We've become, I quote Ralph Waldo Emerson quite a bit in my book, because I'm this kind of dyed-in-the-wool New Englander, and I just love the old dead white man's philosophies. And among them is this one statement he made about how things are in the saddle and man is the horse. And we're being ridden by our things, and we're being ridden by this kind of notion of hurly-burly, get around, do as many things as we can. We're all wired up to our electronic gizmos constantly, and just don't even look around and don't seem to, we certainly don't smell the roses. We don't even see them.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why this is not a direct segue into what I'm about to say, but it is something I took some notes on because I did see an article. It was within the last couple of weeks, and it appeared in the Albuquerque Journal. It wasn't a local article. And it was in their food section, which they have every Wednesday, and it was about quinoa, which happens to be that wonderful, it's considered a super grain. It's probably one of the most healthiest foods, and it's a staple of my diet. Mm-hmm. I mean, I eat that, I can't tell you how many times a week. And I see a mixed impact of the popularity of that food. You know, you have your places in town where you can, we do in Albuquerque, certainly in Santa Fe, where you can buy the kind of whole foods, I don't mean the store necessarily, but the whole nutritious foods that we want, organic. And they were talking about that the popularity of quinoa, and it's Q-U-I-N-O-A, for those of you who may not be familiar with it, is changing the lives of farmers in Bolivia, where it grows, people who are living in poverty. And so that sounds really great. It's those good for those who consume the product, and it's really good for those who grow it. But the article goes on to say that it remains unclear whether large-scale commercial cultivation sought by the government now in Bolivia is actually environmentally sustainable or even welcomed by growers. So from the way I was reading, and I was reading between some of the lines, it looks like it's, even though some of those farmers, a lot of them are ecstatic right now because they're getting money from growing this crop that so many people, this grain that so many people want. And so even though the government may not be the industrial food system in that country, it's like the government seems ready to go in there and take over the cultivation of this crop, which I myself right now am very suspicious of things that are organic and are coming from China and even South America. I've been questioning the stores a lot. I think they may be getting tired of me. How do you know it's organic? Well, the USDA has to check it when they do these checks. But I read somewhere recently they only spot check like maybe 1% or 2% of things that come in. So I'm bringing this up because there are good signs more and more people are eating these kind of foods, but also it's in what happens then to the quality of the cultivation and where it's cultivated.
Well, I think that the interest in the narrow, perhaps, or singular interest in organic food has led to this, the pursuit of food that we don't really care where it comes from. In other words, if it's organic and it comes from China, or it's organic and it comes from Ecuador or some other, or it's organic and it comes from Australia, is that better than food that's produced locally and maybe isn't certified organic, but we know, because we know the farmer, that he or she is using sustainable practices? And, this creates, I know, a lot of confusion for consumers. We're being told we should be consuming more organic food. We should be consuming more fresh whole foods and that we should, be paying attention to every aspect of and every morsel that we put into our mouths. And I think that we sometimes probably get too enamored with one concept in that, like organic. And to me, this idea that we would be, importing food from all over the world and maybe we're pursuing it more aggressively because it's cheaper and it's also organic, it really defies the notion of intimacy. I mean, really, how can I have any kind of connection to food that's produced far away and I have no idea, what the procedures are? And how much trust do I put in the governments in those countries that may be providing some safety checks, providing some oversight, maybe some certification. Yes, there's many certifying organizations out there in the world that are certifying fair trade or certifying organic or certifying some aspect of the production system and the whole food chain that are important to us and that they respect our values. However, I'm becoming increasingly concerned that we're relying on all these various certifications. If we have enough labels on a product that say that they're fair trade, they're organic, they're not violating the rainforest, that they are doing this and that, does that actually make us feel better? It certainly doesn't put me in closer contact with my food. In my book, I tell a story about walking into a college cafeteria. It was the Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, and the food service dining service there is operated by Bon Appetit, which is indeed, I think, the best college dining service.
Progressive.
Very progressive. Probably the best in the country. I mean, in every respect. And I was in awe at the time when I walked in and I saw a dozen different labels or logos of different certifying agencies and organizations on their wall, and Bon Appetit proclaiming that they buy food based on these types of labels. And I thought about it afterwards, and I said, is this what we've come down to? Now we're going to rely on everything being certified by somebody, licensed by somebody, permitted by somebody, in order to assure us that this is the kind of food that we want. Now, I would hope that over time we could find better substitutes for that. But again, I'll go back to my argument that I'd much rather know, the farmer. I'd much rather know that maybe I had a hand in producing it, that I had some direct experience of that food and not simply somebody's pretty cool-looking logo that's been, nailed to the wall.
The reality, though, however, is as many people, and that includes myself, that wants to grow at least some of my own food, it's really very, very difficult for me to, because of schedule and time, to do that. I did make that attempt, thank goodness, last summer, and it was really great. But we want that reassurance because people are becoming more and more aware and concerned about pesticides and antibiotics and hormones. Mm-hmm. And so I could speak for myself and other people, and I'm putting our faith in some of those labels and a certification of organic. Mm-hmm. And we're caring more and more, at least as a large population of people, about these issues, which you have spent a lot of your professional life dedicated to: food justice, food democracy. Mm-hmm. And we want to know that perhaps the folks, the food that we're buying were fair traded. The people working under conditions that were good.
I buy fair trade coffee. It's organic. But it's interesting, this is maybe a little bit of a violation of some principles. I actually buy it from a company called Equal Exchange, which is based in Massachusetts. And it's because I actually know a good number of the people who founded that organization. Mm-hmm. And it's a worker-owned fair trade roaster and distribution company.
And they make great chocolate.
And they make great chocolate, too. They're certainly one of the first fair trade coffee distributors in the United States. I somehow feel better about buying coffee, even though this coffee is shipped to me from Massachusetts to New Mexico. And I thought about it. I was talking to my wife the other day about this. I said, gosh, I'm leaving this terrible carbon footprint. Maybe there's a source for good coffee somewhere much closer than Massachusetts. I know there is. But for me, it was an experience of knowing people, of being involved in the social and economic organization of a company, and having that opportunity to see it firsthand, that makes it more important to me. Yet I understand that we can't all have those sorts of experiences. That takes a lot of time, and I've been a community food person for 40 years, so it's likely that I'm going to know more of these kinds of people. So I respect the need for certainly for certification, and I certainly in most cases I trust them, but I don't think they should be a substitute for going out and having a direct experience on a daily basis with food yourself.
This is Women's Focus. I'm Carol Boss. I'm talking to Mark Winnie, who is the author of the new book, Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners and Smart Cooking Mamas, Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture. Well, I just mentioned a moment ago food justice, food democracy. You want to talk a little bit about that concept and how that is connected to the food we eat, that we consume?
Well, food justice is, which was what I pretty much focused on in my first book, Closing the Food Gap, is about the simple notion that each one of us, no matter who we are, no matter what our income is, no matter where we live, no matter what our race or ethnicity, is really entitled to have the best food possible. And the notion of perhaps of injustice comes down to the fact that 15 to 16% of the people in the United States are considered either hungry or food insecure. I think many people know by now that New Mexico has among the worst food insecurity and hunger rates in the country. We also know that obesity is really tearing up the nation, and its impact on lower-income people, on Native Americans, and on Hispanics is much higher than it is for white Anglo populations. And also the fact that many of us simply don't have access, easy access to affordable grocery stores. There are one-third of New Mexico's counties, about 12, are considered food deserts, rural food deserts, and because people have to drive more than 10 miles to get to any kind of grocery store. So these are the food gaps, and they're also the symbols of food injustice in this country. And what makes them more, disparities perhaps more significant in my mind is that so many of us are pursuing this great food. You know, Whole Foods is a company, is growing dramatically. We have farmers markets sprouting up all over the state. Many of us are shopping there. The organic food line, even though it's still a relatively small percentage, is the fastest growing segment of the retail food industry. So two things are going on. You know, the haves have access to some of the best food that we've ever had in this country, while the have nots are eating at food banks, getting food stamps, and shopping too often at Walmart. So That's the side of it. But there's another gap which I actually start to explore in more depth in Food Rebels, which is this question of food democracy and the fact that none of us really have a very good opportunity to influence the direction of our food system. You know, yes, we as consumers, we can go out and make choices. We can spend our dollars and we can do all these things that, sort of help us as individuals. But where in the much larger scheme of things do we have a chance for our voice to be heard about how food is produced? And when I've 40 years of experience of working sometimes with in state legislatures, spending some time in Washington, D.C., working on bills in Congress, I see how undemocratic the food system is. And how difficult it is for, people who care about their food to have a voice. I mean, we see this in New Mexico too often. You know, we see the large agricultural interests essentially dominate the legislature. They really have control in terms of the bills that go through there. Try to get a bill through that's going to limit the ability to use GMO seed, for instance. It'll be squashed by the food industry. Try to provide more regulations for New Mexico's dairy industry, which is a significant polluter of our groundwater resources. It'll be squashed.
I want to just say, in your book, you do a good description of that, and it was really a revelation to me. I didn't know quite how bad it was.
Yeah, and so these are the things we don't see. I mean, most of us don't spend much time in the state legislature, or even our city councils, or our county commissions. You know, we don't know what is going on in the back room, and the only place, in effect, where we can influence the food system is in the marketplace where we make decisions. But that's not enough. I mean, where we make consumer decisions, but it's not where we're able to actually make decisions that are going to determine what kind of agricultural practices will be used. I find it, frankly, unfortunate that First Lady Michelle Obama recently endorsed Walmart because Walmart had agreed to reformulate a number of the products that they sell to reduce salt and sugar and fat, and also try to get more of their stores into some food desert or lower income communities. Why I find it unfortunate is because she basically acted on her own. She didn't consult anybody. It was kind of a unilateral decision, more or less, to endorse the nation's largest retail chain. I find that problematic. That, to me, is not a democratic way of making decisions. You can sort of turn the bully pulpit, or use the bully pulpit of your position, and to endorse a type of retailer who has notoriously, you know, run amok of all kinds of laws and concerns that communities have. You know, paying low wages, not paying health care benefits, having numerous lawsuits brought against them for harassment and so forth. So I think that we need to be a little more careful. But let me just say that food democracy really is about our ability as individuals to actually have more influence than we would just based on what we purchase, but also based on how we're able to direct our entire food system.
That probably, that whole idea of food democracy and what we can do, and the stories that you share in your book was extremely educational for me. Mm-hmm. It's particularly the empowerment that food policy councils, mm-hmm. which I want to get into in a little bit, allow. So I was, I just lost my thought here.
There must be one of those tags in the book that has something.
one of these many tags in there.
Yeah. If people could see your copy of my book, they would see.
I've really added a lot of color to it.
You have. Yeah. You've actually made it about 2 inches thicker also.
All right. Now you're exaggerating slightly. So let's talk about, I know what I thought of. You wrote in your book about in New Mexico, I think it was, New Mexico Beverage Commission, the attempt of parents and teachers to try to get the soft drinks full of sugar out of schools. And that was accomplished, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
But it was very, very difficult because they put roadblocks every step of the way.
Yeah, the New Mexico Food and Agriculture Policy Council, along with Healthy Kids, which is kind of a coalition of physicians and parents and some teachers and healthcare professionals, pushed the legislature and the previous Richardson's administration to bring rules to school food. Can we get some kind of rules governing what will be sold or what will be available and what won't? And this is going back about 3 years now. Finally, the legislature agreed and the governor agreed to create a task force that would recommend those rules. Well, so they conducted a series of public hearings. And it was fascinating to go to one of those at an Albuquerque high school in the auditorium, and where there were 8 or 9 representatives of the soft drink industry, none of whom were from New Mexico. They'd all been flown in from out of state. They were all extremely well-dressed. They were all extremely well-coiffed. They had more. They had an alphabet of soup of letters of their credentials after their names. After each one announced themselves, they would go on for probably an additional 10 seconds to make sure you knew what they what their academic credentials were, and their licenses and so forth. And it was fascinating to watch how they would defend Coca-Cola or defend Pepsi and defend what they felt was the right of children to be able to drink that and to be able to purchase it in our public schools, that these were the iconic brands of America. And who are we to deny access to our children to these most important features of our culture? And I was just shocked, and then shocked by their behavior and the kind of the disingenuous arguments that they would offer. And one could at that day, on that particular day in that high school, walk around and have seen 51 soda machines, all in public spaces, in quarters, cafeteria areas, not in a classroom or closed up room, but open to children. So anywhere you went in the school, you had very easy access to a soda machine. And these aren't, I sometimes, they're sort of benign, aren't they? Well, I remember the soda machines of my day, and they're these kind of cute little red things with kind of rounded shoulders, and there was a little lever on them, and you put a quarter in, and a 10-ounce bottle, glass bottle of Coke would come out. And that was like a very special thing that I would get to do about once a month. Well, here they are. These kids are overwhelmed with these giant, brightly lit, glaring at you, screaming at you for you to use them. I want you is what they're saying as this poor 17-year-old walks by. So the long story short is that this task force made its recommendations that they should get these soda machines out of the schools, that they should get more healthy food into the schools, that they should control the use of competitive foods, which are the sort of the contract foods that come in to supplement the food that's available with that's offered by the school lunch program. And they won, but it was a battle. And this has been a battle in almost every single state in the country. Right. I tell stories about this in other places as well.
Let's talk about some of the organizations and people that you write about in your book. They're really tremendous and very inspirational and heartening. And perhaps we could start with, and these are probably the people you referred to in your title, Smart Cookin' Mamas, the Happy Kitchen, La Cocina Allegra in Austin. Is that right?
That's right.
And the name of the chapter is God Didn't Make Nachos. So you want to tell us their story?
Yeah.
It's a program. The Happy Kitchen is a program under their Sustainable Food Center.
Yeah, the Happy Kitchen is run by the nonprofit organization, the Sustainable Food Center, based in Austin, Texas. And what it does is, and in some ways it's not terribly different than a number of other food education programs around the country, but it works mostly with lower-income mothers who, for various reasons, have decided that they need to do something about the food they eat. In many cases, these are women who are overweight or obese, or they see their children becoming overweight or obese. They see their own parents now sick with diabetes. They see a pattern of unhealthy eating, and they don't feel that they're able to get control over it. They don't know how to do it. Many people are motivated, frankly, by a fear of something going wrong with their bodies, or they have seen that with their parents' bodies. And that's the reason they joined this program. And what it simply does is it just teaches you how to buy healthy, whole, unprocessed food, and then how to prepare simple but tasty meals with that food. And it was a series of classes that the mothers would go through. And 99% of the participants are women. And they are the primary chef and nurturer in the family, and they are learning how to prepare healthy. And I sat in on several classes. I interviewed about 30 of the participants over the course of a week, and I was really stunned by how powerful the experience is for these folks. They lost weight in a pretty short period of time. Their children started to lose weight. One woman told me she went from a size 16 to a size 10. And they tell me various stories about how they would, what they had learned from their mother wasn't necessarily the right thing with respect to food. One woman told me that her mother had cooked with love. And I asked her, what does that mean, she cooked with love? Well, she cooked slowly. She took like all afternoon to prepare the evening meal. And she did everything, with grace and style. And she would seem to use all of her senses as she was preparing the meal. But this person I'm speaking to says, well, she didn't cook with knowledge. She had love, but she didn't have knowledge. So as a result, she was using too much lard. She was using, using too much sugar, using too much salt, and not using enough, unprocessed ingredients. So this woman had learned the knowledge part from the Happy Kitchen, but at the same time, she kind of brought her own sense of love, I'll call it intimacy, into the kitchen as a way of preparing healthy meals for herself and her whole family. So this was really a tremendous experience. And the other thing that I noticed in particular about the people I talked to was that they became much more confident after going through this program. Their self-esteem seemed to grow. They would shake your hand firmly. They'd look you in the eye. They'd describe what was going on. They became quite articulate once they had some confidence in themselves, confidence that seemed to be bestowed upon them by the fact that they now knew how to cook well. I wonder if I could read one little comment from one, just a paragraph, if that's okay.
Sure.
Yeah, this is a woman named Dorothy who lives in a housing project in Austin, and sort of typical in so many ways of the women I spoke to. She was overweight. She had five children. She was struggling with a lot of issues, but the one thing that she could get control over was her food, and this is what she told me. She says, "The Happy Kitchen gave me confidence that made me feel more positive as a mom. It empowered me to be able to make healthy dinners for my children, and seeing them start to like vegetables gave me more confidence." But she gives her spiritual partner just as much credit. "I always count on the Lord to help me think clearly. Eating healthy has a lot to do with knowing God. Our body is a temple, as the saying goes. After all, God didn't make nachos. He created fruits that grow from the trees and vegetables that grow from the ground. He created cows and chickens, but not the lard to fry them in." There was a long, almost prayerful pause and a searching glance upward. "I seek the willpower," she said, "to use the knowledge, and I ask for the strength and willpower to make other changes in my life." And what Dorothy had done was go off and start to work, volunteer in the community, particularly with young people, helping them to learn how to cook, and just became a very active member of her own community. And it was a way of giving back, and it seemed very, very much linked to this sort of growing confidence that came from food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful program. Wow, I can't believe how fast the time is going. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about a couple of the other people you wrote about. They're really wonderful chapters. It's just incredible. I wanted to talk about Maurice in Cleveland and also the farmer's cow. Can you talk a little bit about those dairy farmers? It's beautiful, actually. It's a beautiful story.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The farmer's cow is this comes out of a group of dairy farmers that I was in Connecticut for 25 years. I became actively involved in trying to protect farmland in the state. We were losing a tremendous amount of farmland. And I started to work with a number of farmers, particularly the dairy farmers, because they were the ones that actually owned the largest tracts of operating farmland at that point. And, we could do a number of things that began to get people to pay attention to what was going on to our landscape, but we weren't able to quite get them to connect around food. And so this one farmer whose name is Robin Chesmer, who I always think is sort of like almost the quintessential food rebel, went against all the orthodoxy in the dairy industry and said, you know, I'm not going to just sell my milk into this big, giant, undifferentiated pool anymore. I want my milk to be known as my milk, and I want it to be known as, you know, Connecticut milk. So he basically organized a partnership of six other dairy farmers. And keep in mind, these are dairy farms, typical Northeast dairy farm of, you know, anywhere from 300 cows to maybe 1,500. You know, those are, that would be a puny farm, puny dairy farm by New Mexico standards. And they created this brand called the Farmer's Cow, and they have their own, you know, they have it bottled by another processor. They've created line extensions like ice cream and yogurt and some, I think they're doing some cheese now. But the thing that they do that's different than just about any other larger kind of commodity style production operation is they invite people to come to the farm. Said, come here. We want to show you what we're doing. So they organize these wonderful tours, and people just are fascinated by what they see. I mean, they want to know how you handle the manure. They actually standing there next to the manure pit say, what is this, and what do you do with it? And mm-hmm. and then they're talking about the animals, and they get very close to a 1,200-pound heifer, and the thing moos like you just wouldn't believe, and all the children jump back. And to me, that, you know, that's intimacy. That's how you get close to your food. And it's that connection to the consumer and their willingness to educate the consumer that actually drives the sales and is making that a much more successful business than they would otherwise.
And as Robin Chesmer says, it's as much beauty as business. It's as much art as science. I think he said it, romancing the farm. Yeah. I just love that concept. Let me play. I got to air something from one of our underwriters, and that's just going to be take a few seconds here, and then we'll be back to talk to Mark Winnie.
Program support by Albuquerque dentist Dr. Joanne Allen, now offering removable dentures. No teeth or no problem with Dr. Joanne Allen, and she accepts Medicaid. Information available on the web at bestalbuquerquedentist.com/dentures.
Okay, this is Women's Focus. My name is Carol Voss. I'm talking to Mark Winnie, W-I-N-N-E, who is the author of the marvelous book Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners and Smart Cooking Mamas, Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture. Okay, probably have around 14 minutes or so, and I am very clear. We're not going to talk about everything that I wanted to cram in. But tell us about Maurice and Cleveland, and yeah. It's so much about what can happen in community. It's very,
yeah,
very
Maurice,
powerful.
This was one of the more remarkable people I met. I mean, I'm so fortunate to be able to have this opportunity to get out and meet people and then share their stories. I just feel honored to be able to do that. And Maurice is this sort of tall, lanky black man living in Cleveland, Ohio. Big fountain of sort of Rasta curls that kind of go all over the place. He looks a little bit like Medusa, who's had too many cups of coffee. And but he's a guy who decided that he wasn't going to succumb to this sort of inner city young guy hustler thing. You know, he did that for a while, but he had a whole set of values around the idea that this community has to be better than it is. Now, Cleveland, if people know, has been a hard hit Rust Belt city. They've lost half of their population over the course of 20 years. They've lost a tremendous amount of buildings that have created a tremendous amount of vacant lots. And so Maurice said, I'm going to try to turn these vacant lots into gardens. And that's exactly what he did. In fact, he said to me, I'm tired. I got tired one day of seeing the same vacant lots as an adult that I saw as a child growing up in the housing projects of Cleveland. And he got out there, started to organize neighbors. I mean, he has this unbelievable 1974 pickup truck all rigged up with all kinds of gadgets and gizmos and housing on the back to contain, you know, the wildest collection of farm implements you've ever seen, and drives around the city and works with people to try to fix up these lots. And he's been at it now for about 15 years. And the thing that I find striking about him is he's, you know, he He says, you know, he really understands, of course, and having lived in that city and as a black person can only experience the kind of prejudice and racism and so forth that he has experienced, and experienced the kind of poverty that is so much a part of Cleveland. But he doesn't get depressed by that. He sort of rises above it and says, what is the good that we can find in this place? And what are the assets and resources that we can pull together to make it a better place? And it's very simple. So vacant lots are one, people's strengths, young people willing to work, institutions like the Cleveland Clinic, which give you space, and then universities and colleges like Oberlin College and Case Western Reserve University that will buy the food. So he's working with farmers now as well as urban growers, and they're now selling over $2 million of food a year to these institutions. Thousands of gardeners or people have become gardeners. And the thing that I even find the most interesting about it is the way he's been able to bring in the city and Cuyahoga County to support this work as well. And now they're protecting the lots by changing the zoning to actually protect these community gardens. They're using money to spur the development of gardens, you know, economic development funds, literally seed grants. And they're even using the buying power of the city to buy food for schools and other public institutions. So it's kind of a complete circle, you might say, a complete loop from developing these sites to using the resources of city government and the authorities of city government and the purchasing power of city government, just again to kind of it shores up the food economy, it shores up the entire economy, but at the same time it really engages people in solving their own problems. And if I can find it, I'd love to read just a little tiny snippet.
Yes.
Here we go. Let me read this to you. We were actually walking around in this garden that was right next to the Cleveland Clinic, and we had previously been looking at driving around the city and just seeing. I mean, everybody on every street corner was overweight and obese, and it was a pretty sad situation. But you know, Maurice was very hopeful that through these gardens, you're going to begin to turn things around. So I say to him, while admiring the compact image of sustainability that lay before me, which was this garden, as well as the industry of Maurice and his colleagues, I wondered out loud if projects like this were really enough to turn around the kind of social and economic dysfunction that I had witnessed all over Cleveland. At that point, Maurice grew animated. He lowered his gangly frame to the ground in a basketball crouch, as if challenging me to dribble past him. Pointing to the garden, he said, "We're going to make this the model, man. You got to tweak 'em. You got to get that virus in their veins. Yes, it starts in a poor community because a wealthy community wouldn't accept a compost pile." It was then that I realized Maurice had a plan. He wasn't just some hip-hop version of Johnny Appleseed planting vacant lots across Cuyahoga County. Gardens like the one he was jumping up and down in were part of a longer-term, hands-on version of revival that used the resources of empty land, institutional strength, and small groups of willing neighbors and sheepish teenagers to make something happen now.
Do you still keep in touch with Maurice?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Of course, I sent him a copy of the book, and he was all embarrassed and everything. And then he gave a copy to his mother, and his mother read the whole thing. And he told me later that his mother came up to him and said, "You know, Maurice, I actually understand you."
That's great. So with the time that we have left, I wanted you to touch on food sovereignty issues as well. And in that, you talk about Native Hawaiians, but you also talk about the Jicarilla Apache tribe here in Albuquerque. Can you briefly talk about the importance? What is food sovereignty and the importance of that?
Food sovereignty is perhaps another variation on food democracy in the sense that, you know, we have the right and we have the opportunity to produce some of our own food, that we shouldn't be dependent on others outside of our area for the food we eat, and that there shouldn't be any forces out there that restrict our ability to produce our own food. And that's essentially the idea of food sovereignty, in the same way that the Native American tribes are sovereign nations. The idea that they have the right to control what goes on within their borders. Food is something that we have the right to control as well. And I talk a little bit about the Jicarilla Apache here up in northwestern part of the state, how they have been working trying to bring back some buffalo into their lives, teaching young people about some of their native foods. Actually start at their own supermarket so that people didn't have to drive 50 or 60 miles to get to a supermarket. These are sort of immediate manifestations of food sovereignty. I mean, we see it now among Native American tribes that are saying, of course, realizing all along that they have enormous obesity and diabetes problems due to, the forced adoption of the white man's diet. And that they had, were forced in many cases to give up their native diets. They're trying to get back in touch with that as a form of food sovereignty, but also, of course, as a way to try to address the underlying health problems that in too many Native American communities are really, really taking a severe toll. Mm-hmm. I also talk about food sovereignty on a global scale where American imports, or rather American exports here, but imports somewhere else, have robbed some countries, and I talk about the case of South Korea, of their ability to be able to produce their own food. We can produce rice cheaper here and ship it to South Korea and sell it to South Koreans cheaper than the South Koreans can grow their own rice. There's a lot of reasons for that. But among them are the fact that the U.S. government subsidizes rice production in this country, and we grow it on enormous scales in ways that are not sustainable. And the Koreans, for them, rice is a part of their culture. It's part of their identity. And anything that would undermine that, should be and is verboten to the point where the South Koreans said we will not sign a free trade agreement with the United States if it requires us to import U.S. rice. Now, this issue is still on the table with respect to meat. We have some Senator Baucus who's an advocate for the U.S. ranching industry, meat industry, wants to ship U.S. meat to South Korea. Well, the South Koreans don't want it. Because they're scared I can't remember the bovine sponge.
RBGH?
No. It's from eating mad cow disease.
Okay,
That's what they're worried about, and they have legitimate reasons to be worried about those things, but. In the course of creating this free trade agreement between the United States and South Korea, the Koreans said, we take rice off the table or you have no deal. And, of course, the U.S. is interested in selling more cars and more gizmos to Korea, and Korea is interested in shipping more of their electronic products to us. So that they agreed to do that. Food sovereignty is becoming more and more of a concern, both domestically and internationally.
So, Mark, we just have a couple of minutes left, more or less, and I wanted I know towards the end of the book you talk about that it's not enough, you say, to satisfy your own desire for simplicity and good food and to only be an informed food consumer, which is definitely a good thing, but you need to be an informed food citizen, which consists of the whole issue of food justice, who we support and what we support, and public policy, speaking up for policies. So now I'm going to ask you again to touch on this shortly if you can. Mm-hmm. Food policy councils, that's like I said before, that made one of the biggest impressions on me.
Yeah. We have a state food policy council in New Mexico. We have one in Santa Fe. We have one that's forming in Grant County, one, I believe, in Taos as well.
And what essentially do the food
They essentially are a collection of citizens who and people involved in the food system as well as people working in government, such as in health or social services or economic development or planning. And coming together, you actually begin to work on food issues, on the food system, in a way that we don't have a place where we can do that. There is, interestingly enough, no Department of Food anywhere in the country. No city, no state has a Department of Food. Well, the Food Policy Council actually becomes this place where stakeholders, where citizens, where experts, where professionals can sit down and decide together what kind of food system do they want. And how do we use the policies that are available, the authorities, the regulations, the budgets of government to be able to secure that vision of a healthy and just and sustainable food system for everybody. So that in a simplest form, that's what food policy councils are. They're very much about this idea of food citizenship. I say to people that in the book that you got to get your hands in the soil, you got to get your vegetables on the chopping block, and you got to get your voices down at City Hall. Now, these are the three steps that any yes. one of us can do to try to change our food system.
And Mark does have some wonderful tales in there. They're not tales. They're true stories of what people who have come together from all perspectives, who have come together on food policy. That's true democracy, mm-hmm. when all people come together with all different views and what they have accomplished in their respective cities. I want to read something that quoting in your book from Robin Chesmer, who is the Connecticut dairy farmer. And he wrote, to break down the walls between the producer and consumer will not only sell more local milk, it'll bring people closer to their food, the land and nature. The taste of real food and the sight and sound of farming will win out over the mere idea of them any day of the week, just as there is nothing like a live moo, just like you said before, delivered by a 1,200-pound Holstein from 10 feet away to remind you of the sanctity of life. There is nothing like a delicious meal made from farmer's market ingredients prepared by a fourth grader to cement his or her bond with cooking. The senses lead, the ears fill with the thrum of life, the eyes confirm our subjective experience of the world around us, the nose advises the palate of what's to come, and the palate never lies. By bringing what's outside of our bodies into them, we experience a kind of ecstasy, a joy in life that in turn takes us outside of our bodies. We are displaced, but happily so. And you quote Emerson again, saying, the power and genius of nature is ecstatic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Good. Thank you.
So Mark Winney's book, Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cooking Mamas, Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture. Boy, I tried very hard to squeeze in a lot of it. And there was more. How did you score a blurb from Meryl Streep?
Oh,
which is on the back of your
right.
book.
Meryl Streep gave me a blurb on the back of my book.
Does she live in Connecticut?
She does. She has a house in Connecticut, and she was very gracious over the course of several years to be our celebrity co-host at some really tremendous food events that raise money for farmland preservation in the state and has led to a number of tremendous outcomes. And I was lucky to get to meet her, and I mean, she kissed me on my cheek, and I have not washed that cheek since.
Oh, Mark. Mark Winney, W-I-N-N-E. His website is markwinney.com, and I guess that will lead to your blog, too, will it?
That's right. That takes you to the blog. There's excerpts from my book, other writings that I've done. There you see a list. I have a pretty heavy appearance schedule because I'm not rich and famous, so I have to get out there and push this book like a three penny book peddler.
How is it going?
It's going pretty well. It's lovely to get out there and meet people and talk about something I love, and they seem to enjoy. Of course, so many people love food and all the issues around food these days. So it's really not a hardship. In fact, it's a joy. But yeah, it's also a lot of work too. But you can see where I'm going, or if I'm anywhere near you, I'd love to check in. I'd love to hear from people, so send me a note. You can also buy the book online off of my blog. And I think there are some independent bookstores in the region, Santa Fe and Albuquerque, that also are selling it.
I hope so. Are you going to be at any local bookstores?
Don't have any plans. I was just at the University of New Mexico giving a talk last week, and that was great. It's very exciting to see students, young people, that are really getting on board with food and who seem to care so much and so passionately about it. So I do spend a lot of time at colleges and universities around the country, and that's giving me lots of hope as well.
One thing that we didn't talk about and we don't really have time to go into, but I want to mention, you talk about, education and, and in Santa Fe they're doing...
Cooking with kids.
Yeah. And you talked about when you start that young, and if high schools had that somewhat in their curriculum, that within a generation or two, it would make a huge difference.
Yeah, I mean, we need to take food education much more seriously. I think we need to go from nursery school to the nursing home. In every respect, food has to be a big part of our lives. And if we learn young enough, we'll appreciate, the time and the attention and the joy associated with food production and gardening and cooking and sharing and so many other things. And why not make that investment now rather than when, you're sick, you're on insulin. The cost $100 per child per year for the Cooking with Kids program, it costs a whole lot more for one sick person's insulin as an adult. So I think it's a good investment to be making now.
And you can read more about that program in the book, too. Thank you, Mark Winnie. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Carol.